Garrett Ilsen here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. Prolific in producing for the likes of Sony, EMI Records, Ninja Tune, and Daptone Records, and composing award-winning soundtracks for film, TV, and advertising. His industry and recognized work spans an impressive 3 decades of collaboration. From working with major and independent record labels to composing and producing for children's television, such as Paw Patrol, Rastamouse, Apple Tree House, and advertisements or syncs for Galaxy, DeLorean, Mentos, and Microsoft, to name a few. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got composer and producer Andrew Kingslow. Where do we find you in the world? How are you doing? And what's happening in your life?
Oh, my word. The opening gambit. Where do we find you in the world? Well, you find me most days working from my studio in London, or moving in and around London, working with artists and music artists, doing elements of mentoring as well. But I'm a music producer based in London that spends a lot of time writing for artists, film and TV.
Let's rewind. At what age were you invigorated or motivated to get into the music world, and how did that journey progress up until present time? So the long form or hybrid version of Andrew's journey.
This is quite fun. I mean, I noticed that the word savant in the title or yes, in the podcast title as well, which is quite fitting actually, because music for me wasn't so much, and you may hear this a lot, but is it for, you know, from a genuine sort of like authentic point of view from me, I just saw musical instruments. Actually, to be specific, my sister brought a guitar home to the house when we were both at primary school. I was 4. In fact, no, I wasn't even at school yet. I was 4, she was 6. I just kind of thought, oh, what's this? What does this thing do? This looks interesting. Picked the thing up, and just before I knew it, I was sort of working out how to play certain stuff. It's super simple, you know, nursery rhymes and things, but I'd worked that out, at which point it's like, okay, this is interesting. This is for me. And it kind of really, the first few years, it wasn't like a remarkable thing. But then by the age of 7, something just clicked and I just wanted to do music. And then it was like, what other instruments can I bring into my life? Fortunately, I had a very supportive upbringing. My parents were very supportive and encouraged anything to do with music. From where I was from, wasn't particularly an affluent area. So to be able to, follow something different that might be able to kind of elevate you from the situation was great for them. And they were super supportive, but I would start, I need to play drums. So they'd find me drum lessons. Oh, now I need to play piano. So they'd find piano lessons. And the whole thing kind of snowballed, and it got to a point where people were starting to notice. So it was suggested at that point, maybe that I do an audition for a place that I'd never heard of, but quite a famous music school where they gave scholarships to children that showed a particular musical talent. And I was successful in my application, which led into me essentially spending six or seven years incredibly intense musical education, oral training, instrumental training. That the whole day was kind of like structured around that. I mean, we could go on later into what that means later down the line in life, but at the time, this was a super honored. You know, I was in a very lucky position to have been given that. But I spent the time there. After that, it was really, music was just the progression. After that point, everything I did, I kind of consumed music. I heard it in a very clear way. So I ended up going and doing a degree in music, essentially for a while playing with various sort of symphony orchestras in and around the north of England. I'm originally from Manchester, which then brought into some London orchestras, you know, the north kind of Liverpool Philharmonics and Halle orchestras that are quite well known colloquially around the northwest and in fact in the country. But then I kind of realized there was a lot of driving around, a lot of moving around, and it was quite a transient lifestyle. You know, it was hand to mouth. You were eating from gig to gig. You were looking for your next gig. It's the trials and tribulations of being a musician, essentially. And started to try and think to myself, well, how do I move sort of transition from this into a more kind of like creative role in within music, and one where I actually can see I'm building myself a future, I guess, which involved me basically, but taking 10, 20 quid from every gig that I ever did that was a cash gig, I'm going to say, and literally, I swear to God, putting it in a shoebox under my bed. And I collected this money in a shoebox, and until I got enough money together to buy a secondhand Apple Mac. Now, I'll give you a clue as to my age. Now, that was around 99, 2000. I saved up £110 it cost to get myself a Mac Quicksilver, at which point I thought, right, I'm going to teach myself to be a producer now.
Okay.
There's the road to ruin, I think. It's like, if you ever wanted to give yourself what's the word? Oh God, what's the word when you that theory when you never think you're good enough? You might know this.
The
Imposter
imposter
syndrome.
syndrome.
Imposter syndrome. If you want to give yourself imposter syndrome, decide to do something where whatever you do is judged by anyone and everyone who knows nothing about music yet is allowed to have an opinion. I spent 3, 4 years kind of messing around and thinking, yeah, I'm great. No, I'm rubbish. No, I'm terrible. No, I'm brilliant. And eventually, I managed to sort of make contact with some of the sort of better known people within the Manchester community, sort of producers and DJs and the likes, and ended up kind of working quite closely with them, which was that was the funnel into getting my own publishing deal down the line. And then that publishing deal led into more growth and moving me into TV and film. So I signed with Sony, well, they were EMI then, but changed to Sony quite quickly in 2009. I had quite a long relationship with them, did a lot of TV stuff, did a hell of, I toured a lot as well in the interim. I've graced the stages with anyone from as varied as BB King through to, oh God, I don't know, at the pop acts of the time as well, all sorts. A lot of blues and soul I did. So what was running concurrently with or alongside, should I say, the production stuff was the touring. So during that time I ended up creating or becoming having a quite a good relationship with a label, a team of musicians called the Dat Kings, who I now work with quite very closely a lot, which has led me to do some really exciting projects. So my journey, who I am, what I am, it's a bit of a mishmash of lots of different things. It's all based around music, and it's given me great opportunities. But post the Sony years, during, I probably burnt out in around 2015, took a year out, and then I've slowly been transitioning back into music in a way that's sustainable for at my point in my career, and to make sure that I don't burn out again as well. In a nutshell, I've always done music, I'll always do music, and now we've also transitioned with my business partner into sort of looking after other artists and doing kind of mentoring as well, like I said earlier. But yes, that's it in a nutshell.
Okay, so lots to unpack. First of all, you mentioned that you have learnt and have had lessons and you know how to play a number of instruments. Are there any instruments that you prefer over and above the other, or you like them equally the same?
Okay, so each instrument brings its own set of enjoyment and set of things to the table. I always gravitated towards keyboards and piano simply because it felt the most complete. Especially as a producer, you kind of tend to think of orchestration whenever you're sort of approach a project is how do I orchestrate this? Orchestrate to me doesn't just mean using the instruments of the orchestra. It means how do I arrange it from top to bottom and left to right and everything in between. And piano, not only can you see everything in front, I'm actually looking at my piano now, which is just there, but not only can you see every single key in front of you can also see how they kind of relate to each other sort of in a physical way. And the way you've got octave one and it wraps into octave two, three, four, five, it's just there, it's complete, it's everything for you to see. I can look at that piano and I see Bach, Rachmaninoff, I see Debussy, I see Elton John, I see Ray Charles. Every single artist brought something to that, to a keyboard, made themselves sound completely individual, yet the keyboard itself is just the same. It's the same medium. It goes for all the instruments, but that's the first one that resonated to me in that way. Quite interesting to me when I start to unpack it myself.
So now tell us your journey at the school that you mentioned that you got a scholarship at. What did you learn? What was the school like? Was it only music? Tell us about that experience.
I mean, I'm quite open about it. It was a place called Cheetham School of Music. It was local to me. And I think, honestly, to every child, there were like 2.6 teachers. It was the most ridiculous, but I mean, they weren't all full time, but in terms of staff
Yes.
versus pupil, it was incredibly intense and very privileged. It was very focused. It would be split. So every day there would be an element of oral training every day. So the interval recognition for those that are sort of like musically aware, or that are listening. It would be, yeah, interval recognition. It would be memories of patterns. We'd be doing things in retrograde. We'd be doing 12 not everything that you could think of. It was all, how can I put it? Incredibly focused. It's just incredibly focused. And then, after that point, we would move on to instrumental lessons. There'd be choir, there'd be orchestration, there'd be music history, all of this at the age of 11, by the
Wow.
way. So,
Wow.
and you think, you're a sponge at that point. So
Yes.
what I learn and what I, retain from that experience plays into my life every day. On the potential flip side of anything like that, you're asked to move from childhood to adulthood very quickly, because the responsibilities that come with that form of learning and that intensity. They had a similar, this again, this was a long time ago, but there was a very I don't know, similar ethos to say that of the Russian ballet schools at the time. It was
Oh,
super in,
yes.
without saying too much. So
Yes.
there were. It's a very, I'm not gonna go as far as draconian, but certainly strict
Yes.
in the way that time was run for you. And we were practicing at 7:15 in the morning. School started at eight, half eight. School finished at 8:30 at night.
Oh,
It was,
wow.
yeah. So it's a hothouse, and further down the line, you think, where did my childhood go? Because
Yeah.
you, I mean, it was great fun, and we're very resilient as children. But there is, it does come to that point. It's a balance, isn't it? It's what you get from, what you get from something, you have to give back somewhere else, I think,
Yes.
in life.
And were there a lot of kids at the school?
No, there were about, I think per what we call set, there were about 25 per
Okay.
year.
Okay.
So the whole school in its entirety had about 200 children.
Now, then you mentioned that at a period of time you had that imposter syndrome of whereby you were doubting and then you're good and then you're doubting. So during those periods of time when you thought to yourself, oh, I'm rubbish, as you mentioned, how did you pick yourself up and say, okay, I am good, I'm okay? Was it affirmations from outside or was it yourself that brought yourself up to say, okay, well, I actually can do this and I'm doing it?
Do you know what I think you've got to do? You've got to look at the overall, not the. This is about being macro and not micro, because it's okay to feel like you've failed in what you set out to do at any point. But the micro part of that creating is that not everything's going to hit, and not everything's going to hit right. But if you can actually take a moment and look at your macro achievements and what you've done over time,
Yes.
then I think then it shows. I mean, the other thing is, you don't tend to remember the wins as well as the losses, as much as the
Yes,
losses
I know exactly what
well.
you're talking about. I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's that thing. And something I read recently, actually, is that the human brain spends something as high as 80% of its time having negative thoughts. And it's how we amplify or hold on to those thoughts that will
Exactly.
kind of define the imposter syndrome. So I am definitely trying to not say think in the third person, but step out of myself when I'm having that moment and think,
Yes.
I'm just having this moment. And later, this moment will have passed, and I'll be on the next phase. So it's almost like you go into an auto mode when you know it's coming. So you think, all I need to do is put one foot in front of the other, and I will get through this field
Yes.
of doubt. And once I'm through it, then yeah. So there are definitely ways to do it, but I think the other thing is to be realistic about where you are in your career and where you're at, and try to make sure you hold yourself accountable to everything that you do. You are critical of what you do, but also in a way that's encouraging yourself to improve, not get negative and just draw away from it. Because I always found that success happens when it's ready to happen. You can't force success. You just keep doing the same thing. This, but consistently do the right thing and success will find you.
Yes, I know exactly. You've given me so many aha moments as we're talking because my brain is the same as yours. So I love the fact that you've said coming, stepping out of it and observing it as a third person, even though it's still you, allows you to give that perspective and objectivity to know, okay, it's not failure, it's not negativity, it's not doubt, it's this little moment in time and just to pass through it. So thank you for that aha moment. I love it.
The process of creation is the same. I mean, you see a lot of memes
Memes, yeah.
about it. And you do. It's this, I'm brilliant, I'm rubbish, I hate myself, I'm not too
Yes.
bad. That is brilliant. And we constantly go through this cycle.
Yeah.
It's that's the cycle. It feels like the cycle of life, but there we go.
Now let's put on the production hat. When you're producing, specifically for an artist, what is that process? Do they come to you? Do you approach them? Unpack that process of when you're creating for an artist and the collaboration of how it rolls out.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, there are a number of different types of production processes. Is that there could be the one where you write with the artists, at which point you've kind of got to create. Oh, right. Okay. So first of all, I think before you take any project on, you
Yes.
have to ask yourself and the artist, what do I and can I bring something to this?
Okay.
Is this for me? Is this for the artist? Can this work? Do you even just listen to the music or where you think music, the direction of the music that they want to go to? If this is something, and I'm going to use this word again, and I think it's possibly kind of a buzzword at the moment, it's authenticity. Can I bring authenticity to this project? If I can't, if I'm working around it and I'm trying to emulate authenticity, then I shouldn't, then this is the point I think maybe I should step away and they should find the right person. Down the line, people come to you because of the work that they've heard that you've done. If you've got a big enough body of work, then you can kind of cut stage one out because they've come to you knowing that you can bring authenticity.
Okay.
After authenticity, it's compatibility.
Oh,
It's
yes.
are we actually going to be able to work together? Because at the end of the day, you've got to create a very close relationship within a very short space of time. You need to be able to be very open very quickly. Otherwise, it's going to be a very stunted process and you will not hear the truth in the music because you can't be truthful to each other.
Exactly.
So, yeah, authenticity, compatibility. After we've got to that stage, it really then does boil down to creating the bare bones. For me, my preference is an album project or a longer project, not just track by track, but a
Okay.
body of work. Because then
Exactly.
within the body of work, you can express different emotions within each
Yes.
song. It's not like, I need to get everything out in this one song and show the world who I am. It's like, no, we've got time. So I think after that point, it's about building the bare bones. Say if they've brought a body of work that's been written, it's about identifying exactly what it is that the song's trying to say and using, I guess, musical onomatopoeia. You use the music to drive the emotion so that when the words come through, that they're supported and there's no dichotomy or paradox, whatever it is between the music. There's no disconnect between the music. And the lyric, there are no rules as such. I mean, in the sense that there are confines in like a bass has to do a certain thing and a piano plays in a certain way and fits a certain way. The way in which you then express through those instruments is so open to the feeling between you and the artist as well.
Yes.
It's to say, and another analogy that you used to use when you're producing a song or writing a song, you're looking at like I don't know, a sheer cliff face, and you're looking
Yes.
at that one
Okay.
finger holes to get you on your journey. And it's like, where, how do I do this? It's there, it's all there to be done, but it's the journey that you take to
Okay.
get to the top that kind of creates the song. I know these are just ways that I sort of like feel when I'm starting on a project. It's like, what
Yes.
do I do? That blank canvas thing is an incredibly daunting situation as well, actually. So
Yeah.
it's become a lot easier for me now because there's certain parts of it that I leave to my subconscious. But the bottom line is emotional connection, authenticity, and compatibility, I think.
It's very interesting hearing this. And then when you're approaching production for an artist compared to production for music or song for a movie or for an advertisement, what are the differences between those?
So this, I mean, I would say that if it's to a picture, then the music is a slave to the picture.
Okay.
It's there to support the picture. I'm getting slave's a strong word, but
Yes.
it's definitely second fiddle. It's there primarily to either create tension, to support, supreme case in point, horror films. You've got the
Yes.
most inane kind of like da, 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 someone going just out buying a coffee, but you've got this
Yeah.
running underneath, and already you know there's something awful about to happen. It's the what music can do to pictures, just in one drone or a certain choice of instrument, really drives the listener and the viewer's experience of what the film's doing. In production for a song or an artist song, the production is absolutely a slave to the song. It should never get in the way of the song. It should support the song. It should carry the lyric. And I mean, this is me talking from a songwriter perspective. I generally tend to work with songwriters, so my personal experience is that I'm there to make sure that the emotion of that song is captured and delivered in the most genuine and elegant way possible.
And with advertisements?
Oh my God. Right. Well, generally speaking, you've got a mean 29 seconds or
Yes.
15 seconds to create the arc, the
Yes.
classic. We'll talk about the arc of the music and an
Yes.
advert, a very short arc. So
Yes. So is it more difficult then for an advert, or is it easier? Would you
it's, I
find
know,
it?
God, no, it's not.
Okay.
Well, I mean, we go into a different we go into a different world there, because you know, with an artist, as long as I please the A&R and the artist, everyone's happy. With an advert, I've got a whole creative team,
Yes.
a whole creative team that you're working through, and a lot of ad work has been done to, in fact, you know, ad work gets done to it gets thrown out. It's a brief, so it'll get thrown out to multiple parties. So not only are you competing against yourself, you're competing against a whole bunch of other people who are also competing against their imposter syndrome at the same time. And I mean, we all talk about the fable ads have these big sort of paydays. You know, if you get the right ad and it gets a worldwide blah blah blah, it's a big payday. But oh, to get there is a tricky one. I generally tend to work on the 80-20 principle with most things in my business now, and I will put 20% into something that has a n not a very heavy success rate. In writing for art, you have to be super succinct. You have to hit the emotion again incredibly quickly, and you've got such a short time to do it. Now, it's been great, but you're creating a world in seconds. You're creating a
Yes,
musical world, and
exactly.
you've only got a number of seconds to do it. And it's an art form in itself, to be honest. And yeah, but it's I've spent a lot of time working with some quite big ad companies. In fact, you know, at one point that I was working on the same piece of 30-second music for 1 month every day. Yeah,
Oh my God.
I know. So, and I think we went through seven cellists, seven different performances on cello. All playing the same melody until we found the right one. And this is when you've got multiple creatives involved as well. You're a producer in a way, because you're trying to appease all the different parties. You're
Yes.
talking to the financial side of the business, you're talking to the creative, you're talking to the visuals. They've all got a different idea of what they want, and everyone's in the middle trying to work out, well, what is it that we all really want?
Yeah, it's all based on perceptions.
Yeah, semiotics, it's the power of suggesting. You're trying, and within advertising, you're trying to make some, you're trying to create a call to action. You're trying to make someone do something that involves spending their money and giving it to you. I mean, for the most part.
Yeah.
So that as a concept in itself is a difficult one for me to get my head around.
Yeah.
I don't do as much advertising as I used to.
Okay.
But anyway.
Moving on to my, that's moves me to onto my next question. Do you do still do touring, or do you not do
Oh,
much of
cannot
that?
do. I really miss it. But at the same time, I don't miss the schlepping about and all the travel and stuff. But
Yeah.
I think the last gig I did, it was the Montreux Jazz in, I mean, I've done some of those, like the old festivals here and there, but in my earlier, in my more formative sort of musical career, I had like a residency, a bar, like a jazz club that I played every night, two sets a night for ages. I think we got, I think it was something like 30 quid and as many gin and tonics as you could handle. So
Okay.
it didn't work out great. So I think what I'm trying to say is that the and people are a lot more on top of this now, actually, but the mental impact on being out touring, being flights, early starts, late
Yes.
finishes, the constant to-ing and fro-ing, it was really tiring. And I know this is coming from what seems like a privileged position to have been on all the tours and gone out all over the place, but I've walked many miles in a touring musician's shoes, and it just became too tiring. So I don't tour anymore. It's not that I'm not open to the idea, but it has to fit into my lifestyle and my sort of
Yes.
like mental capacity and my wanting to protect my mental health, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the audience only sees that one show. They think it's all glamorous and all, but it's hard work. It's not easy. On a plane, off a plane,
Was it?
different time zones, all sorts of things.
It is, and even then, even I kind of inside think, stop being so precious when I say these things out loud. But when you're in that moment and you're sleep deprived, your lobby call to get the next flight was 2:30 a.m. when your gig finished at 11:30 p.m. because you're in Austria and you need to be in France for the next TV show at 2:00 p.m. And these things happen. You're like, how do I keep going? How do I keep going? And it is, and when you get to the top, the organization is much, much, much better. But what I tended to find, even though they were fairly successful tours, is that when they were being advanced by people that were in LA who think that France and Austria is like a short tube journey or something. Well, we could get them into France and then Austria, and then we should be able to get them over to London the day. It's like, my God. And then when you're on the ground making the moves, it's so tiring. Yeah, don't get me right. So don't get me wrong, it was great fun. Great fun. Festival was great fun. And I have very fond memories of it. But touring is something that I would do with reticence, or at least definitely for the right gig with the right people.
You mentioned you do mentoring for other artists or younger artists. What does that entail? And do they approach you or you approach them?
What does that entail? That basically entails being honest and open enough to tell people where and when I made mistakes, and they can choose to take that advice or not. As often we'll know, the only way to really learn a lesson is to make the mistake yourself. But it is, I just found, okay, so, full disclosure, I was diagnosed ASD 3 years ago. I mean, obviously, as we know, it's become a very big thing within our industry. I think a lot of the things that I struggled with earlier in my career were kind of trying to operate within quite a neurotypical environment, being neurodivergent without knowing it. The mistakes that I made a lot of the time were due to my meltdowns that I didn't realize I was having, and lack of understanding of how to operate within that environment. And my mentoring really has become very much about people that may be having similar experiences that aren't as far down their journey as myself. And that happens a lot in music. This idea of being able to hyper focus on one thing for a very concentrated amount of time to get that 10,000 hours in, even sometimes before the actual physical 10,000 hours. Like we said, there's a balance in everything. To be given the ability to do one thing usually detracts from your ability to do other things. And for me, there was a lot of stuff I found myself now in hindsight being taken advantage of for my willingness to do things just because of the fact that I absolutely lived and breathed and loved music, and then other people would be capitalizing on what I was doing and had the guile to monetize what I was doing, or take my work as the whatever it was. I'm not going to throw stuff out there, but my mentoring comes now is to, and what we're doing actually, we're actually partnering up with some quite well known people within the industry at the moment, setting up a series of kind of talks to talk about how we can create a mental toolkit within the music industry. I've even touched on the burnout and things like that. I've experienced it. Awful, that idea of not being able to get up. You just can't get up anymore. So it's about seeing the signs, not collecting too many red flags before you fall over, but seeing the signs and knowing what to do and how to go easy. The number of times people have said to me, you need to go easy on yourself. You need to be more forgiving of yourself. Now, someone with my mindset, everything's about performance. It's about KPIs. It's about, am I doing better? Am I getting better? And if there's that moment where you're not, it can be debilitating. So all of that, and again, everything that I've said earlier kind of feeds into what we're trying to say now, which is like, think more macro. Think about how you're doing in the whole. Think about how you're doing holistically, how your health is, how your creativity is. How, if you can get your mental health to a good state, then your creativity will improve. With that, because you're freeing up space to be creative. When your mental health is messed up, it's the negativity that stops you, that stops you from being able to work. So my mentoring process is about trying to help people understand how to break through brick walls when they hit them and stuff like, just through my own experience. I am no doctor. I'm not saying this in any way other than it's an experiential thing for me. It's like, what have I done? How can I help? You're just talking about stuff with people as well. So I've spoken for the MU. We're about to do something, hopefully with BAPM, where we've teamed up with one of the main London lawyers, and it's about neurodivergence within, the music community, and it's a space to be open and honest. That's generally what my mentoring entails: open and honesty, and being very open about the mistakes I've made, where I've made them, and how they impacted me.
What's next on in your journey? What projects, anything you can speak about?
We're about to make a feature film. I wrote the music to a kids show called Rest the Mouse about 10, 11 years ago now. It was very popular it was on the BBC, and we've managed to get that into a film format. We've got script, we've got all the music together. It's going to be a brilliant, brilliant musical film. We've got some incredible artists that we're collaborating with it on as well, which will all sort of unfold in the near future. Some great acting talent is actually very exciting because we're exec producing as well. So again, me and my business partner and the people that originally did the BBC series, the producers of the show, we've kind of teamed up to take it into onto the big screen. So yeah, that's super exciting. I'm being more active within the kind of world of how kind of mentoring as well. So we do much more of that. I think it's a very good time, especially with the potential toxicity of the social media around us, especially in the neurodivergent mindset as well. It is hellish. I regular attend events by the social media kind of giants, TikToks and the likes, and we who have yet to really connect with what it's like to be neurodivergent and thrown into a world where the funnel of success is, to get to be successful, you have to have great social media stats. That's a prerequisite for music now. So I'm hopefully going to be working a lot in that field. I'm quite passionate about that, actually. Yeah, I am producing. I've got a couple of artists in at the moment. I'm producing for. There's a bunch of stuff. So that's the sort of stuff that until the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, I'm not really at liberty to say,
Of
but
course, yes. Of course, yes.
always got some good things on the horizon. So for
Good.
now, I'm writing every day. I'm about to jump on to start a writing session now. So
Okay,
it's,
cool.
yeah.
So I look forward to hearing all of that. I love this game. My recipients don't always like it, and you'll understand why in a moment. Now, I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 days, 2 hours, 2 weeks, 2 months, I know your answer will be different every time. But if you had to push play to five songs by a variety of artists or different artists, once we've finished this conversation, what would those five songs be and by whom?
Really? Okay. Woo. Okay. Wow. I would say Breathe by Pink Floyd. and then I would, oh my word. And then after that, I would, oh, you can see I'm an old soul head here because I would probably throw on Lovely Day by Bill Withers as well. Or songs that make me feel good. These are all ones that kind of open my chest. Born Slippy, Underworld.
Okay.
It's all about that. That reminds me of a lot. Step On by the Happy Mondays, and because I'm an old manc at heart as well, I'd say The Only One I Love by the Charlatans. The Only One I Know, sorry, by the Charlatans. There you go. That's a bit of a mix. Nothing very modern, but
No, that's cool. I love playing this game because I love
that
hearing
song.
people's responses.
Yeah, it evokes such a memory. Do you know what it is? Memory through songs for me, I can
Yes.
takes me right into the room, and they're happy places, though.
Yeah.
So,
So the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say to the audience?
That's the big question, isn't it? What would you like to say? I'd like to say, keep weird. Please just keep weird.
Keep weird.
Keep
Love it. I mean, I fit into that category. So,
it weird. Keep it weird. It's a great place to
exactly. So, guys, as Andrew says, keep weird, stay weird, and keep going.